rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Sir Winston Churchill, our quote for the day, have always felt that a politician is to be judged by the animosities he excites among his opponents. Coming up on today's program, Paul Rykoff, author of Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington, will join us in the second hour. Alec DeBro will be getting us up to date on the growth of unions in America in our third hour. Right now, Al Garza is with us. He's the executive director of the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps. Their website, Minuteman HQ, as in headquarters, MinutemanHQ.com. Al, welcome to the program.
Tom, good morning to you. Thanks.
Good morning. You are, I'm assuming, the Minutemen that everybody is always talking about when they say those vigilantes down there on the border.
That is us. But we're certainly not the vigilantes. I think we're compassionate. We're eager beaver to do what the federal government is refusing to do, and without incident, by the way.
When are you guys going to realize that you're being played for suckers by the Bush administration?
Oh, we realized that right from the get-go. But the fact is that regardless of what we're called and regardless of what the president thinks or anyone, we know we're doing the right thing. Our heart is in the right place. We know we're addressing a very serious issue, and that's border security.
Well,
so
here's,
we're going to stay on it.
Here's what I mean by this, Al Garza. In the 600-page piece of legislation that's working its way through the Senate, that's, you know, the amnesty, whatever you want to call it, this comprehensive immigration reform, there is a sentence which says, and I quote, "Employers of aliens applying for adjustment of status under this section shall not, employers shall not be subject to criminal or civil tax liability relating directly to the employment of such aliens."
Wow.
Now, if you really want to stop illegal aliens from coming into the United States, instead of spreading yourselves across a 1,000-plus-mile border, why don't you set up perimeters around some of these big meatpacking plants or some of these construction sites that are all over the country where they're actually sending recruiters down to Mexico to hire people and smuggle them into the United States?
Well, we are. As a matter of fact, that's one of our second online operations. We call it Operation Spotlight. We've been doing this now diligently for the last year. That's part of our agenda. We have definitely addressed that, and we are definitely very adamant about our border security, number one. And obviously, if you address the employers that are hiring illegal immigrants, there would be no room for amnesty or any guest worker program. So we're still working on that.
Well, I don't think that there would be any more illegal immigrants if you did away with the employers.
Well, that's a fact, because that's really the lure. The lure, and on top of that, obviously, the public services. If you address that diligently,
So then why go down and, you know, stand in front of the border unless you're doing it, you know, as a PR stunt to get publicity about the issue?
Well, this is certainly not a stunt. That we've been very very aggressive in the way we perform this, and we are simply the eyes and the ears of the Border Patrol. And in the last, just in the last couple of years, we've been instrumental in the capture. Now, we haven't done the capturing, the detainment, the Border Patrol has, but we've been their eyes and ears by simply observing, spotting, and reporting, just an extension of the Border Patrol.
I'm talking with Al Garza, the executive director of the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, MinutemanHQ.com, the website. I got to tell you, Al, you know, when David booked you for this show, I was expecting and prepared to argue with a guy who was going to come off as a racist, xenophobe nutcase, and you're not sounding like that to me. What's wrong?
Well, that's the portrayal of the media, obviously, right from the get-go, something that most Americans are not used to. Obviously, they didn't understand. If there was any racial impact behind it, I certainly wouldn't be involved in it. I've seen what the Minutemen have done. They've been very successful. And by the way, just in the last couple of years alone, we've saved well over 380 lives and passed out 10,000, if not more, gallons of water, clothing, food, etc. So we're not really what we're portrayed to be. We are really compassionate. We love people in general. We just are totally against illegal immigration.
Why?
Well, illegal is illegal. I mean, if it was, let's take it back down to the 50s.
Well, jaywalking's not illegal, too, and I don't see you guys positioning yourselves on the corners of every street.
On the what now?
Jaywalking is illegal, too, and
well,
you're not
yeah,
out there.
Jaywalking is this one classic example of what our politicians are You know, they would definitely punish you if you jaywalk, but illegal immigration per se, there's a lot of impact, not only negative. I mean, you're talking about vandalism, crime. You're talking about deserts being destroyed. People's ranches are destroyed, their animals, their herds, their cattle, their horses, breaking the windows, breaking in.
What, Neil Horsley's getting down there?
I'm sorry?
Oh, never mind. I'm sorry. It's a local joke. It's the reason I said jaywalking is because two reasons. Number one, there have been more tickets issued for jaywalking in the United States than there have been employers fined for hiring illegal aliens in the last couple of years.
I totally agree with you.
And number two, the penalties for jaywalking are, it's a misdemeanor, are about the same as the penalties for being an illegal alien in the United States or for hiring an illegal alien in the United States. And yet, this is an issue that is so easily demagogued, and it does bring out the racists and the nutcases and the xenophobes, the people who are, as we had this Bill O'Reilly, a week or so ago, going through this whole thing about how, you know, this is, you know, we got to save our culture and protect our culture and all of this. And I mean, you know, American culture has always been fairly inclusive. It's just that we have intended, our goal has been to be inclusive in a way that doesn't damage labor, I would say, frankly.
Yeah, well, you're touching on something that's real important out here. See, I'm a border town child up here. I've lived here for a couple of years, and the impact is just severe. It's to be regarded as not only absurd and an insanity, it's an influx of illegal immigrants coming through, and in the wake of their journeys, I mean, the destruction that's caused and left behind is just horrendous.
Yeah, yeah. This is Bill O'Reilly. I think this is a clip that relates to this.
The newspaper and many far-left thinkers believe the white power structure that controls America is bad, so a drastic change is needed. According to the lefty zealots, the white Christians who hold power must be swept out by a new multicultural tide, a rainbow coalition, if you will.
But the fact of the matter is that, we've had a significant percentage of our population has been African American since the founding of this nation. I mean, they didn't have the right to vote for a long time, but do now. More than half our population is female. It's not white male Christians that O'Reilly purports to represent. Are you guys about, you know, white culture, in quotes?
No, not at all. Not at all. As a matter of fact, we've got, about 8,000 volunteers nationwide, and about 15%. Well, let's say 10% are Hispanic, I myself included. We've got black, we've got Asians, we've got Samoans, we've got different nationalities. And we all believe in the one thing, and it's our Constitution. And we also believe that we are under the rule of law, and we're addressing public safety and national security. I mean, now those are three components that cannot be overemphasized.
Al Garza with the Minutemen, MinutemanHQ.com. You have been portrayed in the media. And again, I mean, this is what I was assuming when we booked you to come on this program, as having a conservative slash Republican slash right wing agenda. Is there any politics about what you're doing?
Not at all. This has nothing to do with politics and everything to do with, again, safety and the securing of our nation. To have open borders as we have them today, in particular the border towns up along the 2,000 mile spread from Texas all the way through California, they're not only porous, I mean, they're completely, they're dangerous, let's put it that way.
But we've had those open borders for, you know, 100 plus years. I mean, going back to, what, 1848, the war with Mexico? The annexations, whatever
true.
You want to call it.
You're talking about a different age. I mean, you know, we can always talk about Labracero times when I saw them.
Sure.
These people had dignity, they had honor, their word was very important to them. Today, it's totally different. There are too many lures out here in the United States, for example.
But again, couldn't you argue, Al, that Al Garza with Minutemen, couldn't you argue that were there not employers hiring these people, they would not be coming and we would not have an issue and there'd be no need for a fence and there'd be no need for you guys to be standing there?
Well, that's partially true, but still you need some sort of protection, because whether you've got if you've got the employer, then let's say you eliminate that, you still have other issues. You've got medicine, you've got public services, Social Security, benefits that they claim when they get here. And this is another lure. So if we stopped all that, yeah, along with the employer, yeah, you.
It seems like the remedies are remedies at law rather than remedies of offense, because we historically had those remedies and we didn't have, you know, this migration. Real quickly, Al, we're just about out of time. What makes someone an American?
What makes someone an American?
Yeah.
Well, I would say, first off, the loyalty that you would show. You obviously consider the laws to be important. Under one flag. I personally was involved in I was in the Marine Corps. I was in combat, so was my father. We believe in one thing. We believe in America. You pledge allegiance to the United States of America and things of this nature. But most countries, or most people that come here, they have something different in mind.
Very, very quickly, Al, why are we not seeing you guys outside big, big businesses that hire illegal aliens?
Well, we are there.
We are there. I mean, why is the news not reporting that?
Well, maybe it's not important to them. What's important to them is apparently our people have not caused any problems, which we...
They want the photo ops. Al, right. we're out of time. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Al Garza, MinutemanHQ.com.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let's impeach the president. Neil Young there from his new album, Living with War. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, that was a surprise. I love to get conservatives on this program and have a good fight with them, or a good discussion, shall we say, a good argument. And I was expecting this guy to be totally off the wall. And instead he's talking about how they've saved hundreds of lives. They've dispensed tens of thousands of gallons of water. It's all this... Wow. So, anyway, we'll see how this all shakes up, this thing. But like I said, I think this is not an insignificant issue. People say, this is just a wedge issue. I'm sorry. Roughly 10% of Mexico's population of about 107 million is now living in the United States. 15% of Mexico's labor force is now living in the United States. One out of every seven Mexican workers migrates to the United States. Those are pretty significant numbers. And here, this is why this is going to become a big issue. Here's our...
Now, Behind Enemy Lines.
We'll give you the right-wing spin before you have to listen to right-wing radio to get it. I just got this email from GOP USA. GOP, right? The Grand Old Party USA. Message brought to you by friends of GOP USA. Sort of reads like Go Pusa or something like that. GOP USA. In any case, it says, should illegal aliens be entitled to receive Social Security benefits? According to the United States Senate, the answer is yes. Now, keep in mind, the U.S. Senate is controlled by Republicans. Illegals granted Social Security. That was the front page headline in Friday's Washington Times. And then they go on to attack Democrats for it. Democrats. And yet, as far as I can tell, this thing passed with votes from Mike DeWine, Republican, Chuck Hagel, a Republican, Richard Lugar, a Republican, John McCain, a Republican, Arlen Specter, a Republican, Ted Stevens, a Republican, George Voinovich, a Republican. Seems that... Now, the fact of the matter is there were a lot of Democrats voting for it as well. But this is going to be the spin. The GOP is trying to make it that the Democrats are all in favor of illegal immigration, tearing down the border, turning America into Mexico or vice versa. And if you're a racist, you should be afraid. And if you're a culturist, you should be afraid. And frankly, I'm just concerned about the future of labor in the United States, particularly organized labor. And there are two ways that the membrane of the United States, the economic membrane, the thing that has held together labor, has been punctured. The first and the biggest is with our international trade policies. NAFTA, CAFTA, the World Trade Organization. Basically what they did was they said, okay, labor in the United States can no longer be protected by protective tariffs. We protected labor in the United States with tariffs from 1787 up until basically the last 15 years or so. Or the last 20, 25 years. Going back to Reagan for all practical purposes. We protected labor in the United States with tariffs. And now we don't do that anymore. And so our jobs get shipped offshore. Those jobs that can be shipped offshore. Whether it's manufacturing or whether in many cases it's even, you know, things like engineering. But there are a lot of jobs you can't ship offshore. You're not going to build houses in China and send them to the United States. I mean, maybe mobile homes, I don't know. But if for right now, you can't build a house in China for somebody's neighborhood down the street. So for that, you know, let's import cheap labor. So it's all about cheap labor. Both the export, the end of tariffs, the replacement with these multilateral trade deals, and the encouraging employers to hire people from other countries to come here and work, which, by the way, is what the Bushies have done in Iraq. In Iraq, they've said there's no such thing as an illegal immigrant. Anybody can come into Iraq and work for any price they want, thus driving down the price of wages in Iraq to the point that Iraqis won't work for those wages. So there's all these jobs that Iraqis won't do. Even when they're hungry, they won't do them because it's a net loss for them. And so you've got an underground economy operating in Iraq among Iraqis. You've got 50% unemployment. They're shooting at us because they're upset about it. And in the meantime, we're building a giant complex, a giant embassy complex, you know, 20-some-odd buildings on 104 acres, and not one Iraqi working on that project. Hundreds, thousands of employees from Bangladesh, from Pakistan, from Sri Lanka, people being brought in from all over the world to work on this, but not Iraqis. And it's the same thing here in the United States. The cons are saying cheap labor equals corporate profits. And that's the bottom line for me. That's the reason why you maintain these economic membranes. One of them is called a border, a physical border, although it's really a legal border. I don't think we need a physical border. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll take your calls on this right after this. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. There's a lot of other stuff happening in the world, by the way, that we're going to be getting to over the next couple, next 2.5 hours of the program. Alberto Truman Capote Gonzalez. I say that by referencing the way he speaks, nothing more or less. Has said that he's going after reporters. We have the audio clip of that. Seymour Hersh, NSA is listening to U.S. calls big time. But just to wrap up this immigration thing, Roger Noriega, he was the former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. I believe in the Clinton administration, I may be wrong. He said, and I quote, "The good news is that 1 million Mexicans were on the street recently demanding good jobs and good government and justice. The bad news is they were marching in someone else's country. Every day," that would be the United States, "every day thousands of Mexico's most industrious people leave their families behind, leading many to wonder why Mexico's political class is not capable of creating economic opportunity for its citizens in a land rich in mineral wealth, hydrocarbon, agricultural potential, and human capital." And I would suggest to you that the corruption that you find in Mexico is hand in glove with corrupt corporate power in the United States. And that's, I mean, this is where it all comes down to. You get this whole thing all coming together here is with corporations making money. And now in this immigration bill, there's a sentence in this immigration bill that specifically says that the United States government is explicitly and specifically forbidden from going after employers of illegal immigrants, undocumented workers, whatever you want to call them. Louie in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Louie.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Louie?
Well, you're intelligent, articulate, and I'm just so grateful you're on the air. I happen to be a union vice president at CWA Local 3108 in Orlando. We represent AT&T, Bell South, Avaya, and any other telecom worker we can get our hands on. We just signed up 2,000 state workers, so we're kicking
great.
Butt here. Yeah,
that's great. Good on you, Louie.
But we're also trying to get our members to realize the importance of political action, which, you know, when you try to get the COPE money out of them, you know, it's hard. Then when you start saying, look, if this bill passes XYZ, you might be out of a job. And that opens their eyes to how politics is important to their job future.
Yeah.
But I really like the Al Garza gentleman that was on. Again, I think a lot of the press wants to paint them as right-wing wackos, and they sure don't come across like that on any interview I've seen.
Yeah, it boggled my mind. I mean, I've known people like that. I mean, I've interviewed, 3 years ago I interviewed David Duke. I mean, I've talked to these guys, and usually the real right-wing wackos, David Duke, for example, he knows how to sound like he's very mainstream, but he's always talking in code. And if you know
right,
the code,
exactly.
You can decode the code really fast and just throw it back in his face. And I was expecting that. I was just waiting for these code words to. And then he comes out and he goes, "Oh, I'm Hispanic." You know, and no, we're out there taking. You know, I'm like, "Wait a minute. You know, what am I missing here?" And I'm befuddled. I confess, I just don't know what to do with this thing.
Well, I think a lot of Americans, including myself, realize this is a much bigger picture than just illegal immigrants. It's things like NAFTA, which, as a union guy, we were against NAFTA, but the selling point, even by Clinton, is, well, if we improve the lifestyle and income of Mexicans, they will buy, in turn, American products and we can both benefit. And the reason that fell out is because when it passed, all of a sudden now, as their wages went up, they started shifting jobs to communist China.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, during the first couple of years of NAFTA, there were all these maquiladora factories built along the border, and then a lot of them got shut down, and those employers moved to China. You're right. And when China gets its standard of living up, then they're going to move to Burma. You know, it's just,
well, we'll see. The other thing is, I would like to get with the Minutemen, and I'll try to see if I can get online and see if they have one in Orlando, because I think that would be a great union type of strategy to boycott companies that have illegal immigrants, because then. You know, most Americans are very much with us on this issue about, stopping the flow of illegal immigrants, but it's not the immigrants I'm against, it's the employers.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line, that the immigrants are, these are just decent people who are looking for a job, by and large. I mean, there's a few bad apples and a few bad actors, but I would submit to you that anybody who is willing to face going through the hell of the southern United States border is somebody who is strongly for a job is probably a very decent person who's concerned about their family. I mean, look at all the money that's being sent back to Mexico. It's the second largest source of revenue in that country behind oil. These are decent, hardworking people. The problem is that they should be decent, hardworking people in their own country.
Exactly. 97% to 99% are, you know, if my daughter wanted to marry a Mexican guy, an immigrant, I'd probably more than some guys I know that are Americans. I mean, it's the fact that.
Yeah.
You're right. The Mexican government is at fault, along with the corporations here that are corrupting the Mexican government because they don't want the wages to go up anywhere.
Yeah, and then we see this in the Associated Press. If Arnold Schwarzenegger had migrated to Mexico instead of the United States, he couldn't be governor. In the United States, the only two jobs that are reserved for native-born Americans are the president and the vice president. That's it. In Mexico, if you're not a native-born Mexican, you can't serve in any legislative position. You can't be in any state legislature. You can't be in the Supreme Court. You can't be a governor. And you can't work on town councils. You can't get a job as a policeman. You can't get a job as a judge. You can't get a job as a firefighter. And Mexico grants only 3,000 citizenships a year compared to about 500,000 in the United States.
Well, the hypocrisy is thick, and I'm just wondering, the Senate bill is the one that has this clause about the employers. I don't know about the House bill.
Yeah.
You know which one is which, or are they both?
This is the Senate bill that I'm talking about.
Okay, well, hopefully I hate to say this, but I mean, in this case, I'm politically aligned with the House Republicans, and that's true.
I know, and I had this conversation with Congressman Peter DeFazio, who I would argue is the second most progressive member of the House of Representatives behind Bernie Sanders, probably the most progressive Democrat out there, or one of the three or four most progressive Democrats. And he actually voted for the Sensenbrenner bill, and I'm like, Peter DeFazio, why did you vote for the Sensenbrenner bill? And he said, well, you know, the idea of criminalizing people who are helping aliens, he said that wasn't part of the original bill. And Sensenbrenner didn't want that in the bill, but the White House asked him to put that in, and it got in at the last minute. He said, and we always figured that the Senate would take that out. And you know, take it, if you strip that out, he said he thought it was a progressive bill. It defended labor in the United States. And I'm like, you know, there's so few people willing to say that. You know, it's just, and so anyway, Louis, I got to move along.
Well, thanks, Tom. Great show. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Chuck in Philadelphia. Hey, Chuck.
Hi, Tom. I think the only way you're going to do anything is if the attention has to be taken away from the illegal aliens and put onto the people who are really breaking the law, and that's the employers.
Amen. That's the beginning and end of it. I mean, I don't think that we need a fence. I don't think we need a wall. I don't think we need to militarize our border. All we need to do is say, I'm sorry, it's illegal to hire people who are not citizens of the United States. And that way, we the people can make decisions through our elected representatives about to what extent we want to grow the population of this country to meet the needs for employment. Otherwise, we're back to Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages, written in 1914 or 1814, that said that, you know, whenever you have a surplus of labor, the price of labor will fall to a subsistence level. And that's where we're at.
Yeah, but the penalty for hiring illegals has to be realistic. And I would suggest 10 years in jail and $10,000 for each illegal. And then any law enforcement person can enforce it at the local level.
Well, you know, there's already a law in place. It's very simple, Chuck. When you run a business and you have a business expense, there are some business expenses that you can't reduce your profits with. You know, this is the whole three martini lunch thing. There are you can spend up to a certain amount of money for travel and entertainment expenses, and after that you can't deduct it from the revenue of the company. In other words, you have to pay income tax on that money. And employment, having an employee, is a tax deductible expense. So if I own a company and I have, say, you, Chuck, working for me as an employee, I file, I think it's called a 944 or 941 with the IRS, and I list your Social Security number and I say, you're my employee and I'm deducting you the cost of what I pay you and your benefits from my income, and I don't have to pay taxes on it as a corporation. Well, all the IRS has to do is say, you know, this isn't a real person. Or the Social Security Administration, this isn't a real person, and then the company, by law, right now, existing law, the company can no longer deduct that as an expense because it's not a legal expense, because it's not a legal employee. And George W. Bush has the means on the books right now to enforce that law so that Walmart wouldn't have any benefit from hiring illegals or hiring subcontractors who have illegals. The subcontractors wouldn't have any benefit because all of a sudden they'd have to start paying 35% corporate income tax on the salaries of everybody that they're hiring. But nobody's willing to enforce these laws. And to top this off, and Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you.
One more thing.
Yeah, okay. Go for it, quick. We just have a few seconds. Oh, Chuck is gone. I'm sorry. And we're out of time. Mexican President Vicente Fox going through the Pacific Northwest this week. Bill Graves in the Oregonian. He's going up to Washington State. He's going to visit, at the invitation of Washington Governor Christine Gregoire, he's going to visit an apple orchard near Yakima, Washington. Well, this will be interesting. It'll be really interesting to see how this thing plays out and how it gets covered. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just looking over the news of the weekend. Alberto Capote Gonzalez on This Week with George Stephanopoulos trying to put lipstick on this thing here of, we're going to check out what journalists are up to.
So you believe journalists can be prosecuted for publishing classified information?
Well, again, George, it depends on the circumstances. There are some statutes on the book which, if you read the language carefully, would seem to indicate that that is a possibility. That's a policy judgment by the Congress in passing that kind of legislation. We have an obligation to enforce those laws. We have an obligation to ensure that our national security is protected.
In other words, if a reporter says something that the president doesn't like or that Alberto doesn't like, then...
Well, again, George, it depends on the circumstances. There are some...
It depends on the circumstances. Yeah. That's what they say when they're saying, essentially, if we don't like you, you're in jail. If we do, then, you know, we'll let it pass. And so Brian Ross on CNN, he was talking with... Howie Kurtz, CNN's reliable sources, and Howie asks him, well, how do you feel about the fact that you have now discovered that Alberto Gonzalez is spying on you?
Just on a personal level, what was your reaction to learn that law enforcement officials, according to this source, are analyzing the numbers that you dial, presumably in an effort to track down your other confidential sources?
Well, you know, I guess in an abstract way, I always thought that was likely or possible. But once I actually heard this specific information and this person knew a couple of specific calls, it was truly alarming and made you think, well, my gosh, what are we going to do about this? I mean, it means a lot more in-person visits. I'm working on a big story now with people who are confidential sources inside the Federal Air Marshal Service. They were all alarmed that they might be exposed as talking with me in violation of rules. So it's of great concern. And it makes me feel, in a way, and this is, I think, the disturbing part, you know, as if we are drug dealers or terrorists trying to traffic in information, and should we be using bags full of quarters like old mafia capos to avoid having our phone calls traced. And I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. I don't think any other reporter is either. We're trying to cover these stories, which are difficult, but which are very important.
And that's it. I mean, it's very important, very straightforward stuff. And we do need to be covering these stories, which brings us to our final clip from this weekend, which is John Edwards speaking truth about what's really going on here.
You've also said the president is the worst president of our lifetimes.
Yes.
And Richard Nixon?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What has President Bush done that is worse than the crimes and the cover-ups of Watergate?
Well, he's done a variety of things which are going to take us forever to recover from. I think we can recover from. But the damage that he's done to the way America is viewed in the world, the lack of respect for America in the world, what the ongoing conflict in Iraq is doing to America's image, his response to this hurricane on the Gulf Coast, which I think is part of a pattern of incompetence.
So, is it incompetence? By the way, as soon as John Edwards was on the radio, all of us talk show hosts got this thing from RNC Communications. RNC response to John Edwards' appearance on ABC's This Week. Tracy Schmidt, the RNC press secretary, says, John Edwards is faithfully carrying on the legacy of anger and vitriol exhibited by failed Democrat presidential candidates. Don't you love it? The Republicans, they can't even say the name of the party. It's the Democratic Party.
His divisive and permissive and pessimistic rhetoric may appeal to the far left, but it's also further proof that leaving Washington, D.C. does not disconnect a Democrat from his party's agenda.
Yeah. And Edwards, Stephanopoulos. So you're for censorship but not impeachment? Edwards, if I were in the Senate, I would vote for censure. If I had an up or down vote, I'd vote for it. Worse than Richard Nixon? Absolutely. Absolutely. And in the meantime here now, Clarence Thomas. Now, you know you've got a problem when Clarence Thomas is coming to your defense. By the way, if you've seen the Da Vinci Code, then don't go to the top of TomHartmann.com and click the link about the Knights Templar, because it'll just boggle your mind, and you don't need to be boggled. By the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartmann.com, click the live chat link. It'll get you there. So anyhow, Clarence Thomas, Dorothy Bush Koch, K-O-C-H, you know, the big, the wealthy oil family of Texas, is she's married to one of them, Doro Bush Koch. She is the sister of George W. Bush, one of his younger sisters. And I guess his younger sister, the other one he had, died at the age of, when he was seven. And she was at a book party. She was doing a book party for her new book, President Bush, My Father, My President, A Personal Account of the Life of George H.W. Bush. And Clarence Thomas shows up. And he says, we have to pray for your brother. He's in real trouble. She goes, what? But she, you know, she was very calm about it. We'll be back after the news, my friends.
Been listening to the Tom Hartmann program? Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. A lot going on around the world. I think it's important, though, that we remember what's going on in Iraq on an ongoing basis. And so,
Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey! Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Karl Rove. He didn't serve. Dick Cheney. He didn't serve. Tom DeLay. He didn't serve. And George Bush was A-W-O-L.
Here's the news in the last 24 hours. Baghdad, car bomb went off in a crowded street in southeastern Baghdad, killing six civilians and wounding three. Another Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb went off near a market and health clinic in the capital's new Baghdad district, killing three people and wounding 12. Also Dateline Baghdad, gunmen killed a former brigadier general in western Baghdad, an interior ministry source said. Two of his relatives were also killed. In Jafur al-Sakar, four policemen were killed when a roadside bomb went off near a joint U.S. Forces Iraqi police patrol. In Balad, five bodies were taken to the hospital in Balad, north of Baghdad, after clashes with insurgents that erupted in the nearby town of Dulaya on Sunday, according to hospital sources. So on it goes. Paul Rykoff is with us. Paul is the author of a remarkable new book, Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America. From Baghdad to Washington. He's also the founder of IAVA, and IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, IAVA.org, the website. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
Glad to have you here with us. The book, Max Cleland, who is a guy who I have considerable respect for, he was my senator when I lived in Georgia for many years. It comes out and says, you know, this book hit me in the gut. If there's anybody who knows what combat is, it's Max Cleland. Tell us, what led you to write this book?
Well, I think it was frustration, and I'm blessed to have people like Max who have you know, offered their opinions on what they think of it. And it comes from frustration of being on the ground, and I'd written letters to my girlfriend about every 2 days in the year I was in Iraq from 03 to 04. And when I got home, I saw that the war was being thrown back and forth like a political football, and I wanted to inject some credibility into the argument, because the talk show hosts, you know, with all due respect, and the Pentagon spokesman and the generals, they don't know what they're talking about. It's about time we heard from the troops on the ground. And I also wanted to show people how policy affects people. I wanted to show how the flaws in planning in early 2003 and into the summer of 2003 resulted in the growth of the insurgency, the deteriorating security situation, and kind of the corner we've painted ourselves into now a few years later.
So, Paul Rykoff, what is – oh, by the way, chasingghosts.com. Is that the right website,
Chasing Ghosts? Yep, that's it.
Chasingghosts.com, the website for this book. What is the situation on the ground?
Well, I think it continues to deteriorate. You know, the president has always said we have to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. Well, what if we have to do both? We're overextended. We moved troops out of Korea and Afghanistan into Iraq. The insurgency continues to grow. We haven't established security. And at the end of the day, we're not winning hearts and minds because we can't give the Iraqi people what they thought they were going to get. We can't give them security. We can't give them electricity. We can't give them clean drinking water. So, you know, I think we're facing a really uphill battle there, and the president continues to show a very detached understanding of the urgency and severity of what's going on over there.
Well, as Jack Murtha pointed out this morning on national television, but it's not just the president, is it, Paul Rykoff?
No, you know, unfortunately it's not. I think it's really Congress and the Senate and sometimes even the American people. I mean, we're really detached from this war. If you walk around most streets in America, it doesn't feel like a country at war, and less than 1% of the population will serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. And World War II was close to 12%. So, you know, I'm hoping that my book can kind of shake people and give them a personal connection and help them put a face on some of the numbers and help them understand a little more of what we're really asking our folks to do halfway around the world.
World War II, 12% of Americans served, or 12% of American men?
No, I think it's 12% of Americans.
So that would have been about 24% of American men.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just about everybody went to World War II unless you had a legitimate excuse, and that was important because it created a personal connection with our foreign policy, and it also helped shape the political understanding, and then it helped drive our foreign policy. Now, you know, for most folks, it's an issue rather than an experience. They can flip the channel and watch Desperate Housewives. They don't want to deal with it, and it's really altered our ability to convey effective foreign policy. Not a single member of the House or Senate has served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's something that I think needs to change, and I'm encouraged by the fact that I think about 7 Iraq vets are running for Congress, and I hope they can be a part of that change.
Yeah, I think that will be changing, hopefully, in 6 months or so here. We're talking with Paul Rykoff. He's the author of Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. He's also the executive director and founder of IAVA, Iraq Afghanistan Vets of America. And it's IAVA.org, right?
Yes, sir.
And ChasingGhosts.com, the two websites. Paul, what's the, you know, the book is heavily autobiographical. What is the main carry-home message that you want people to get when they read this book? Is it the kinesthetic, the feeling, the sense of the reality of it, or, you know, you already mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, policy has real consequences on real people, or is it that you want to energize people to be politically active?
Oh, I think it's both. I want them to understand what happened in Iraq and the invasion and what happened, you know, a year later and what the costs are, what the ripple effects are, and how it's going to affect not only Iraq but, you know, America's global standing in the world and our military ability to project power in other places. But I also want it to kind of serve as a rally cry to people. I want them to understand that there needs to be a degree of accountability for the failures, not just the weapons of mass destruction argument, but also for the flaws in planning that resulted in, you know, an adequate number of troops, the body armor and vehicle armor problems that continued a year into the war, and the continuing deteriorating situation. You know, we need some levels of accountability. You know, Donald Rumsfeld still got a job, and it boggles my mind. It's not like he's running a McDonald's here. He's the Secretary of Defense, and he screwed up so many times, and he's still got a job. It really just flabbergasts me to think that this guy still has a job. So I'm hoping that this will, you know, encourage people to demand a level of accountability from both sides of the political aisle and really get people more involved about the issues surrounding the war.
Paul Rykoff, do you see any way other than the ballot box for Don Rumsfeld and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and the whole cabal there to be held accountable? Do you see, for example, lawsuits Do you see the possibility of any sort of blowback from the military itself? I think the idea of a military coup is probably unimaginable in the United States. But here we have all these eight generals stepping up, speaking out. This is something that's never happened before. How far can this be pushed? And what are the options aside from simply voting the bums out?
Well, I think it can. We have a lot of options on the table. If you get somebody like Iraq vet Tammy Duckworth, who's running for Congress in Chicago, you get her in Congress this fall. She can demand congressional hearings as to where these planning.
She can't if her party isn't in a majority.
Yeah, well, maybe they will be this fall. I mean, that may be part of it. You know, I think there will be, a serious blowback for the Republican Party because ultimately this is their war. I don't think the Democrats have offered much of an alternative. For most of us, Republicans got us into this mess and Democrats don't have a plan to get us out. But I think there needs to be a sea change in Washington and getting folks like Tammy in office can really start to develop some level of accountability, with regard to the role of contractors, with the flaws in planning, with the rationale for war. All that needs to be fleshed out. We can't just say, oh, that's in the past and it doesn't matter. Because it's why we got to the point we're at right now.
Now, you say, Paul Rieckhoff, the Democrats don't have a plan to get us out, and yet Jack Murtha has laid out a very explicit plan to get us out, and a lot of Democrats have signed on to it. Are you speaking about the National Party?
And a lot of Democrats haven't. I think that there is no unity within the Democratic Party, and I think one of the main reasons John Kerry lost in 2004 is because he couldn't effectively articulate an alternate strategy. And I still think if you ask most Americans where the Democrats stand on the war, you'd probably get 20 different answers. So I think until we can articulate an effective alternative to the Bush plan, we're really going to be looking for new voices. And, it may come from somebody like John McCain or Chuck Hagel who end up outflanking the Democrats because they can't get some sort of a united message together. I think it's important that we've got Murtha's plan out there. But we also need other plans to start to come through. We shouldn't have only two options. I think we've really fallen into a false choice, and people assume you have to either be with Jack Murtha or be with George Bush. And I think, in this country of such rich intelligence, we can come up with some more strategies.
Yeah. And for example?
The Les Gale plan, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, who just wrote an op-ed with Senator Biden to cut the country into three pieces and try to stabilize the security situation and have a central government that controls Baghdad. That's one option.
Another the Czechoslovakia one, plan or the Yugoslavia plan.
Like the Bosnia model. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. A guy named Kovanovic has offered an oil spot theory where we take the existing number of troops and shrink them into one small area, say Baghdad, where you can establish security at least in one area so we can create some kind of a safe haven instead of doing everything poorly.
Well, what we're doing in Afghanistan, isn't it? Basically, we've got Kabul secured and everything else has fallen apart.
Yeah. And
the Taliban's back.
I hate to look at Afghanistan as a viable model because we've diverted so many resources from there that it's really started to fall apart as well. Most of the guys coming home call it Forgotistan because they feel like the American public and the policymakers and the military resources have been diverted elsewhere. So I think, I really want to see a new model because it doesn't look like the two we've got in place have worked too well so far.
Yeah, well said. Paul Rieckhoff, he's the author of a new book, Chasing Ghosts, A Soldier's Fight for America from Baghdad to Washington. The website chasingghosts.com and IAVA.org, the executive director, Iraq, Afghanistan, Veterans of America. Paul Rieckhoff, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
Good luck on your book and keep up the great work. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back in the days of shock and awe, it came to liberate them all. History was a cruel judge of overconfidence. Back in the days of shock and awe.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Ellen Ratner with Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com, our Washington, D.C. bureau chief on the line. Hey, Ellen.
I don't know whether you want to hear about the president's speech or some other fine events that happened today.
Well, both, but I have a question for you first.
Yes.
I just got an email from GOP USA by Bobby Eberle, I think the guy's name was, saying that the headline was "The Big Easy Gets What It Deserves," and it starts out with this thing about how the Democrats in New Orleans just reelected Ray Nagin to be their leader, the guy who was incapable of even marshaling the city's school buses, and therefore people drowned. Now,
except for the school buses were underwater themselves, which a fact that they failed to announce.
Yes, and, well, not only that, also we have testimony now from the governor of Louisiana that she was actually willing to suggest or you know, bring in people. I mean, you know, how are you going to get people to drive them if the drivers are, you know, defending their own homes or whatever? But in any case, she was going, she had buses, and she was going to bring them in. And she testified before Congress that FEMA told her that they were sending buses, not to use her local buses. How long are the Republicans going to be able to continue this lie?
Because people don't do their research. That's why. And so you have these guys out there that, I mean, you know, it's amazing to me, Tom. I, as you know, I'm on the air with you, and I'm on the air with some real right-wing members of our profession. And they will take the sound clips that the RNC sends out to their hosts, not that the DNC can get it together to sound and send any sound clips, plus their sort of thoughts of the day, and I will hear it on more than one station.
Yeah.
So these guys don't even think for themselves, and they do the arguments that they want, that the Republicans want them to do.
Yeah, no, this is what I'm sharing with you, is the RNC's sound clip for the day. They didn't send me audio, but, you know, the message for the day that they want RNC talk show, they want right-wing talk show hosts to be putting out, is that, you know, Nagin was so incompetent he couldn't get the school buses mobilized. That picture was up on Drudge for a week.
And people believe it. And, you know, the other thing Drudge had up there that the Democratic National Committee denies one way and the other is that the Democrats supported Land Rover Nagin. But the Democrats' policy is never to get involved in an election between Democrats.
Hmm.
So I just don't believe it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And they denied it today. Speaking of those kinds of issues, there was a state convention in Connecticut, and Ned Lamont, who is running against Lieberman, garnered the 33% of the state representatives, not representatives, but Democratic committee members' vote. So there will be a primary between Lamont and Lieberman.
Yeah, Paul Krugman wrote a great op-ed piece about that today, about how the so-called centrists in the Democratic Party are not center at all. And Lieberman, you know, it's and what I think is so tragic, Ellen, is over and over and over again throughout the weekend, I kept hearing news reports ranging from NPR to CNN to Fox News to everybody else saying that Ned Lamont, the anti-war candidate, is challenging Joe Lieberman. Well, Ned Lamont, it was challenging Joe Lieberman on the bankruptcy bill, on, I mean, you know, just a whole...
Oh, insurance and everything else. Absolutely.
Yeah, just a whole range of things.
Oh,
I mean,
of course, but they have to paper it. Let me just give you a couple other really fast ones.
Sure.
The Federal Trade Commission announced that there is no evidence that oil companies conspired to manipulate gas prices. They did find out, however, that there were 15 examples of price gouging by the oil companies. Now, I don't know the big difference, but hey...
I was expecting you to say they found out there was no collusion and the Easter Bunny is real.
Right, exactly. The Supreme Court today would not hear an argument or an appeal by a Tennessee inmate saying that lethal injection was cruel and unusual punishment. And you may be aware of this. I'm sure you are. You're usually aware of things even before me. Today, John Murtha gets the Profiles in Courage Awards from the Kennedy Library and the Kennedy Foundation. Nancy Pelosi is going up there. He is now saying, of course, that we've spent $450 billion by the end of the year. We will have spent that. And the White House just announced that Tony Blair, who has just been in Iraq, is going to come and speak with President Bush. There is some speculation that he would like to push pull the British troops out. And Tony Snow would only say he may report on his desires when he comes to the White House at the end of the week.
Interesting. And this is a meeting that was requested by Blair.
Yes.
After a visit to Iraq.
Yes.
Oh, man. George W. Bush is so completely disconnected from reality. I mean, you just get this over and over and over again. When David Gregory said the American people, you know, don't like you, and he was like, oh, they're just unsettled. It's like, it's incredible. Okay.
He did also make a speech today at the National Restaurant Association, which he admitted was the largest employer of immigrants. He was asked by a Canadian about the plan, and he said, the immigration plan, he said he is talking about strengthening the border with Canada. You have a lot of those northern states that are just going bananas because a lot of the people go back and forth, you know, sometimes twice a day.
Yeah, well, you know, the largest Muslim population, if you're worried about quote, terrorists, largest Muslim population in North America is in Toronto. So why are we building a fence in Mexico?
You got it. Have a great day.
Good talking to you, Alan. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
War is my last choice.
Drop!
We're going to smoke them out. Bring them on.
Flip!
You think patriot and constitutional guarantees are in place?
Flop!
The wire that requires a court order.
Flip!
Saddam Hussein's got weapons of mass destruction.
Flop!
Although we have not found stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction.
Flip!
And it is true that Russia and
and welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Drop into our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com and clicking live chat. We were just talking with Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., and she said that Tony Blair has just requested a meeting with George W. Bush within the week. At the same time, the Times Online just published this story. Times Online, the online version of the Times of London, the sort of the New York Times of Great Britain, although it's owned by Rupert Murdoch. It was the grand dame of British press for centuries before Murdoch bought it. And it still is. The headline, the article by Philippe Naughton, British troops to start leaving Iraq, quote, in months, end quote. And here the body of the story, Britain and Iraq announced an accelerated timetable for the withdrawal of foreign troops from much of Iraq today during a surprise visit by Tony Blair to show his support for the country's new government. I wonder if this is going to be the October surprise. Bush is going to actually get us out of Iraq. Or maybe Blair is going to get us out of Iraq, and it'll be the October surprise. Britain could return two southern provinces to Iraqi security control within a few months. Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's new prime minister, said that he expected as many as 16 of the 18 provinces to be Iraqi-ized under the control of Iraq forces by the end of this year. I think we could all read that as by the first week of November. The timetable increased pressure on the United States to set its own deadlines for withdrawal, which Bush administration officials have steadily refused to do for fear of handing a propaganda victory to al-Qaeda-linked insurgents. Well, now that they have a government and it's met and they have a prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, Bush can say, okay, he can declare victory and come home. The British prime minister landed in Baghdad's Green Zone in a Chinook Army helicopter after a hair-raising flight from Baghdad airport in which he skimmed low over the city to avoid attracting fire. He met U.S. and British military commanders and members of the new National Unity Government formed at the weekend after 6 months of wrangling. Although a senior official accompanying him told reporters that the multinational force in Iraq would wrap up its work in the next 4 years, the clearest deadline set yet by a Western official, Mr. Blair refused to be drawn on the precise details of withdrawal. In a joint press conference with Mr. Blair, Mr. al-Maliki was more forthcoming, saying that he expected as many as 16 of 18's Iraq provinces to be under Iraqi security control by the end of this year. He said there is an agreement for the transfer of security under a timetable which starts in June when Iraqi forces will take control of the provinces of Samawa and Amara. The other provinces will be transferred gradually, and by the end of this year, most of them will be under Iraqi security control, with the exception of perhaps Baghdad and Al Anbar. Fascinating. Fascinating. On it goes. You know, surprise visit. Also, it was Blair's fifth visit to Iraq, but only his second to the Iraqi capital. The surprise visit also explained the Prime Minister's absence from Britain's celebrity event of the season last night, the pre-World Cup party hosted by David and Victoria Beckham at their mansion in Hertfordshire. Yes. Everybody in Britain wondering, why didn't he go to the party? Iraq has 7,200 troops in Iraq, by the way. The third largest army. The first largest army being, of course, our 130,000 ground troops. The second largest army being the 20,000 to 30,000 private mercenaries. And then the third being the British troops. Speaking of private mercenaries, federal dollars, this from The Nation, Nation magazine. According to Blackwater, this is Blackwater, the private security firm, you know, they don't just provide security in Iraq, they also provide security in New Orleans. According to Blackwater's government contracts obtained by The Nation from September 8th to September 30th, 2005, this is right after the hurricane, right after Katrina, Blackwater was paid $409,000 for providing 14 guards and four vehicles to, quote, protect the temporary morgue in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, end quote. From September to the end of December, the government paid Blackwater at least $33.3 million. Federal dollars that have been squandered on fat contracts for crony companies, money that could have been used to help families. Blackwater marking up their labor costs nearly 200%, acting as an armed presence containing people instead of aiding them after Katrina. This from the introduction to the Nation article. Cost broke down to $1,328 per man per day. Not bad work if you can get it. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? Yeah, I'd just like to comment about the Democratic Party and some of the great candidates we got this year. You look at, for instance, Marcy Winograd down in California. She's running against Jane Harman.
Yep.
We got Ned Lamont, Connecticut, running against Joseph Lieberman. You know, it's time that we take some of these quasi-Republicans and take them to task at the polls.
I agree.
Lieberman should go down to defeat. And supposedly he's already talking about running as an independent, which shows his...
Why doesn't he just run as a Republican?
Well, that's really what he is. You know, why don't you just come out and be honest about, like, Ben Nelson from Nebraska should do the same.
Yeah.
You know, and let me tell you, you know, personally, I'm running for Democrat Central Committee here in Humboldt County. My name is Jake Pickering. And part of the reason I'm running is because, unfortunately, I've seen so many issues with the Democrats just turn tail and run. Look at the issue of censure. You have Russ Feingold out there with a couple of senators, you know, Tom Harkin, Barbara Boxer, everybody else, you know, turns tail and run. John Murtha. You know, he just tells the truth. This is the whole point. The war in Iraq is a disaster. George Bush thinks the country is unsettled by some act of God. You know, like George Bush forgot the fact that he started the war in the first place.
Right.
You know, we Democrats have to stand up and grab our backbones and tell the truth about Bush. He has totally destroyed our foreign policy. Our country's bankrupt because of his ridiculous policies, giving all our money away to the rich who already have too much as it is. Look at our education system. Look at our, you know, safety net. I mean, he wanted to destroy Social Security. We Democrats have to stand up for the people of this country and put Bush and the Republicans in their place and get people out to the polls. And, you know, if we just say, oh, we're going to do things slightly differently, you know, like Kerry did with Iraq in the 2004 campaign, people aren't going to show up. We have to say it's time to end the war. It's time to impeach Bush and Cheney, and it's time to bring America back to where we should be, Tom.
Well said. And, Jake, I know we've got a lot. We have a lot of listeners there, KGOE and Eureka in your county there. And you said you're running for the Democratic Central Committee there, locally?
That's right.
Do you have a website for your candidacy?
Oh, no, actually I don't. But it'll be June 6th on the ballot. I'm running here in the 3rd District.
Okay, and your name again was?
It's Jake Pickering.
Pickering. Great.
That's it.
Okay.
Thanks,
Jake.
Tom. Bye.
And let me salute you for the work that you're doing, for getting involved in Democratic politics. God bless you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Good morning, Tom. A couple things, if I may, then I have a question for you, if I can. The true measure of a president is in direct proportion to the issues at hand. I have to give Bush and Cheney an F.
Yeah.
True measure of a president is in direct proportion to the issues at hand.
Okay, I'm not disagreeing with you.
And being around the market for 40 years, I think I've crossed this in my mind many times. I think their only last rationale, I think this is the rationale of these people, that the stock market is the last best, and this is my own thinking, the last best financial hope of mankind.
Yeah,
I think that's how they treat the economy.
Yeah, and they're wrong, but the stock market is a measure of how well millionaires and billionaires are doing. The one thing, in my opinion, Gary, that is holding the stock market together, to the extent that it's being held together. I mean, if you check it out right now, let's see, we should refresh the New York Times. The last I looked, it was down 47 points today. It's dropping. And there's a headline over at Drudge, 55 points down now. Headline over at Drudge, the stock market is looking the same as it did in 87 when the bottom fell out there for a while. The only thing that I think is holding it together, or that's stabilizing it, is that there are so many 401ks and pension funds that are invested in the stock market that there are, you know, billions and billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars that are not moving. You know, by and large, they're not going to quickly move. So the stock market is not as speculative an instrument as you could argue it was just a short while ago. And well, not a short while, maybe 30 years ago or 40 years ago. And because pensions, because of the crash into pensions, the decline of pensions. And so it becomes a slightly stabilizing force. That's the upside. The downside, though, is that all these folks have all this retirement money in the market. And much of it, you know, mandated by the laws that provide for IRAs and 401ks and things like that. Basically, you know, our government creating this opportunity. And all of this money in the stock market. And those people are going to get whacked if and when the market crashes. And markets are cyclical. And, they do go up and down. I'm not, frankly, expecting a Great Depression, but I am expecting a serious recession. And, in fact, I would say for working people in America, we have been in one for 4 years. And the direct consequence of George W. Bush's economic and trade policies. And it's probably going to get worse. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our number toll-free all across the United States. Chuck in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Chuck.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. Chuck, what's up?
I just wanted to let you know that the Knuckle Dragger station here in town is all over that Ray Nagin story this morning. So
they're doing the talking points.
Oh, yeah. It's School Bus Ray. They're just right all over it.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're across from Rush, apparently.
Yeah,
I'm a service tech, and I was in a house, and that was what was going on just before I called you. And
yeah.
So over it.
It's amazing. I get this stuff in email in the morning, and I go, okay, there's Rush's show, there's Hannity's show, here's all the local right wing guys. You know, it's like, because I get, you know, three or four of these right wing emails every morning, and you know, they go out to all the talk show hosts, and usually you can figure out which ones they're going to think is the strongest story for the day, and they're going to run with. So,
Sure it'll be on all day, but I just thought I'd let you know they're all over it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chuck. Good to hear from
you. Have a great one.
I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to us and Talk 1090 there. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm just so glad that you're bringing up these contracts. And I tell you, if Howard Dean is listening or anybody from the National Committee, I really think that they ought to centralize on this issue because it's something that unifies everyone.
Are you talking about the Blackwater contracts down in New Orleans?
I am. And all these, not just Blackwater, all these no-bid contracts, this crony capitalism.
Yes.
And show the Democratic Party that we're about entrepreneurs, we're about enterprise, we're about capitalism, not just for those on the inside.
Yes. Yeah, this is a kleptocracy. This, you know, what's going on here, the Bush administration.
It's a sign of fascism, that this crony capitalism, it all goes to the inside group. But everyone can agree, if you bring up the ideology, the war, all these issues that they're in control of outcomes, such as possible October surprise, which you mentioned, of pulling the troops out. But they can't control the hard facts, and these contracts are out there, they're evidence. And if they're how can you justify these things?
Yeah, yeah. It's you can't. in my opinion. I mean, you just can't. They're coming out of the ideology of, well, capitalism, free enterprise, blah-de-blah, you know, as wonderful as it is, does everything better than government. And therefore, whenever government has to do something, whether it's saving New Orleans or whether it's fighting a war, the extent to which we can get government out of the process and put private corporations into the process is going to be a good thing. And what we've seen over and over and over again is that there actually are some things the government does better than free enterprise. There are a lot of things the government doesn't do better than free enterprise.
It's a great argument, but it falls apart when you show that it's only going to a few groups and how much waste and how many trillions of dollars have been given with absolutely no results.
Yeah. Dave, thanks for the call and good point you make. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's like groceries. You know, I was talking with Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org this morning, and he was talking about how the Veterans Administration is going back on the agreement that they made with veterans in rural areas to build local rural Veterans Administration clinics, you know, where they might just be staffed a couple days a week, but there would be a doctor and a nurse who are employees of the VA who would be there for veterans in rural areas. And they're going back on this, and instead they're saying, okay, we're going to give you a chit, a piece of paper, you know, a voucher for health care that you can use with local for-profit companies. And the problem is that it's not enough money. And there's no way to know how much is enough money, and it's going to depend on what the person has and all these kinds of, and so it's not working. It is failing veterans. And when you look at it and compare that to, for example, the success of food stamps, which actually makes sense. Okay, people need to eat. Let's use the private sector to feed them. So we'll give them food stamps, and they can redeem the food stamps at the supermarket. And, yeah, there's going to be a little bit of abuse here and there, but by and large, you set it up to make it very, very difficult. You can't buy booze with this. Frankly, I don't think you should be able to buy anything with corn syrup in it with them, but that's my own personal idiosyncrasy. It'd do away with a lot of obesity. But in any case, here's your food stamp. Now, why does that work, and why is it that health care stamps don't work? Well, because the grocery market actually today, relatively speaking anyway, I mean, you know, Walmart's trying to get into it. That might not last much longer, but by and large, the grocery market still is a free market. There's still free enterprise. Local people, anybody can start up a retail grocery. Anybody can start, you know, and you can get groceries all over the place, and so any place that'll accept the food stamps. Whereas the healthcare market is not. How many hospitals are you going to have competing with each other? They're not. They're going to carve out territories and say, this is our territory. And they're going to be non-competitive. They're going to be natural monopolies, essentially. And then you've got the AMA controlling the supply of doctors. And you've got the pharmaceutical companies have it with a total lockdown on pharmaceuticals. And everybody's got to get their pound of flesh. Everybody's got to make money on it. So it doesn't work. So there are some times when the free market should be part of a solution. There are other times when the free market, in quotes, as you know, when the free market shouldn't be. There are some things that government simply does better. And you know, I'd much rather see the National Guard or the Army Corps of Engineers out there, helping out during a hurricane than paying Blackwater $1,300 per man per day to stand around and guard people instead of helping them. I mean, it is what is wrong with this picture raised to the level of absurdity. And yet that's what we're seeing there. That's what we are seeing in New Orleans. That's what we're seeing in Iraq. That's what we're seeing with everything the Bushies touch. And I guarantee you, that's what we're going to see with any kind of fence or border or security or anything else along the southern border. And perhaps even the northern border. It's going to be another pork opportunity for Bush and all his buddies to make billions of dollars off your back and mine, with your money and mine. I got to tell you, an amazing thing that happened. It was in the New York Times over the weekend about Don Rumsfeld and 10 CEOs. This is incredible. And it involves $21,000 of your money. Right after the news, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Okay, here it is, full page in the Sunday New York Times. Great big screaming. This really got my attention. I'm flipping through the paper, and I, you know, it comes here. I have a weekend subscription to the New York Times, and so this was the Sunday paper, and I'm flipping through the paper, the front section, and because it arrived here in Portland, Oregon, whoever bought this bought the national edition. I'm assuming it was in Manhattan as well, in New York as well. That's a big buy, to buy a full page nationwide in the New York Times, in the Sunday paper at that. Screaming headline. First of all, there's a picture of Don Rumsfeld that is above the fold that covers covers a quarter of the page. A quarter of the entire page. So it's half of the above the fold, the top half of the picture of the page. And behind him, the Pentagon logo. And then this big headline, I'd say, must be about 36-point type. Maybe bigger than that, maybe 48-point type. 10 letters about an inch tall, right? 10 CEOs call for this CEO to be canned. That really got my attention. It got my attention for two reasons. One, Don Rumsfeld is not a CEO. And I think that one of the problems that we have is that we're talking about government, people in government, as if they were CEOs. I remember when Bush and Cheney first came into office, and they said, we both used to be CEOs, and this is going to be the CEO presidency. And Bush says, I'm going to be the CEO president. We're going to run this government like a company. Well, I'm sorry. A company is run to make a profit. Government is run to serve the people. They are two completely different things. In a company is responsible to a small number of shareholders relative to the population of the country and its consumers. It is responsible to a small number. A company is a kingdom. It is the closest thing that we have in modern society. A company is the closest thing we have in modern society to an old-fashioned kingdom, where you've got, you know, kings and princes and lords and under-princes and princes, you know, the whole bit. A company is a king. And somebody working for government is an employee of the people in a democracy. So first of all, Don Rumsfeld is not a CEO. That's my picking nits. That's like, you know, the part of me that gets upset when I hear people say, I felt nauseous. I'm sorry, nauseous means sickening to look at. Nauseated is the word you want. Nauseated means sick at the stomach. Or when they say, we've got to do that. Got means acquired. You say we have to do that. So anyway, for the pedants out there like me, I'm probably mispronouncing that word for really to make you crazy. In any case, 10 CEOs call for the CEO to be canned. It's a catchy headline. And then the subhead, which is in probably 20-point type. When Donald Rumsfeld took charge of the Pentagon, he already knew its books were such a mess that they had lost track of $2.3 trillion. Now that's asterisked. And down at the bottom it says, try to wrap your mind around the enormity of this scandal. $2.3 trillion is $21,000 for every single household in the United States of America. $21,000 for every household in America. That's how much they have simply lost track of your money and mine. $21,000 from your household, $21,000 from my household, that they've just lost track of. Then it goes on to say, and this is signed, by the way, the 10 CEOs, Bruce Klatsky, current chairman and former chief executive officer, Phillips Van Heusen, Frank Greenberg, chairman and CEO, retired Burlington Industries, Ted Williams, CEO, retired Bell Industries, Bruce R. Katz, founders, Rockport Shoe Company, R. Warren Langley, president, retired Pacific Stock Exchange, Patrick McGrath, CEO, retired Jordan McGrath and Case Partners, Alan Klingerman, CEO, AK Pharma, Inc., Roger Mumford, president, retired Matzel and Mumford, a K. Hanoverian Company, M. Blair Hall, CEO, retired Goldman Hall, and Stephen T. Kirsch, founder of InfoSeek. And then there's a bunch of other business leaders below that. And here's the copy. Financial mismanagement and unaccountability. The Pentagon Inspector General recently concluded that financial mismanagement is deeply rooted in virtually all operations at the Pentagon. And just this year, the Office of Management and Budget concluded that 87% of defense programs failed to use strong management practices. In 1990, a law was passed, the CFO Act, as in Chief Financial Officer, to hold government to the same standards businesses are held to. But according to the Government Accountability Office, the research arm of Congress, and I would add nonpartisan, if anything, under the control of the Republicans at the moment, the Pentagon today has no plans to comply with this law. The news is full of CEOs who've been fired or jailed for refusing to follow accounting law. So that's their first indictment of Rumsfeld. Their second, incompetent forecasting. Rumsfeld predicted Operation Iraqi Freedom, originally named Operation Iraqi Liberation, until they discovered that that spelled out OIL. Operation Iraqi Freedom would cost under $50 billion and could last 6 days, maybe 6 weeks, I doubt 6 months, quoting Rumsfeld. 3 years and $439 billion later, a Nobel economist is predicting OIF's final cost will exceed $1 trillion. That's trillion with a D. Or with a T, excuse me. Yeah, with a D if you're German. Mammoth waste. The $640 toilet seat is gone, but outside the head, Pentagon waste is alive and well. 89-cent ice cube trays are being purchased for $20. No bid contracts and prime vendor sweetheart deals guarantee perpetual waste. After tragically underestimating the troop levels required in Iraq, Rumsfeld now pays private contractors many times what U.S. soldiers working on at their side earn. Estimates of total Pentagon waste per year, $35 billion. $35 billion. They continue with the indictment of Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld's backdoor draft broke the bond of trust between military families and the brass. Reenlistment rates are falling. Despite lowering standards, doubling recruitment bonuses, and ballooning its advertising to nearly $300 million, the Army regularly fails to meet its recruitment goals. Here's another one, squandered goodwill. A sterling reputation and the goodwill it inspires is a company's most precious asset. So it is with nations. At Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, Donald Rumsfeld oversaw the trashing of America's good name. And finally, intolerance of dissent. In 2003, General Eric K. Shinseki told Congress that administration estimates of troop levels needed in Iraq were wildly off the mark. Shinseki was soon gone. Critics, whistleblowers, messengers with unwelcome news are dismissed. Why do so many retired generals feel compelled to speak out against Rumsfeld's policies? Because active generals are silenced. This was put out by Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities. Their website is sensiblepriorities.org. That's amazing. A full-page ad in the New York Times. So far, now, they point out that we, $439 billion later, the actual amount of money that has been spent just in Iraq, based on congressional appropriations, this from the National Priorities Project, nationalpriorities.org. Excuse me. The cost of the war in Iraq, $282,642,875,883,887,891,510, $800, and on it goes. It's an ongoing clock. And now that sounds pretty abstract. What does that mean? You know, let's turn those into some real numbers. What that means is that, you know the program Head Start. We know that kids who go through Head Start are less likely to end up dropping out of school. They're less likely to end up in jail. They're far more likely to end up being productive members of society and paying their taxes. You invest a dollar in Head Start, you make $9 back. That's the best guess of people who are advocates for the program. With the money that we have spent in Iraq so far, the $282,643,005,420, we could have paid for 37,436,121 children to attend a year of Head Start. 37 million
kids to attend Head Start. We could have fully insured for all health insurance, eyes, dental, the whole bit, 169 million children. 169,247,358 children for a year with the war in Iraq. I mean, it just goes on and on. We could have hired 4,898,239 public school teachers and paid their entire salary for a year. Think what we could have done with that. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Won't need no haircut, won't need no shoe shine.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Neil Young there, his Living with War album. It's just amazing. By the way, speaking of email, I was talking about all the right-wing email I get from the right-wing talking points for right-wing talk show hosts. I just got one from Hillary Clinton, hillaryclinton.com, inviting me to participate in a house party for Hillary. Host a house party for Hillary. House parties for Hillary are a great way to get family and friends energized and ready to take back our country. Yeah, I think I'll pass. Although, as I've said before, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party, in all probability, I would vote for her. You just, you have to figure hope springs eternal, right? Alec DeBrow, ILCA Online, the International Labor Communications Association. Is it association? Alec?
Beats me.
Yes. International Labor Communications Association, online.org, the website. And, Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. And I am the hope that springs eternal.
There you go.
Although you've had me follow Neil Young, and I'm not sure I'm up to that, but I'll do my best here.
I think we all are. I think that the American people are the hope that springs eternal. The American people have always risen to the task and will again. And that's what I was saying about Hillary. I just keep reminding myself, even when we have a candidate like Hillary, who we don't have yet, but I think it's the handwriting's on the wall, that when Franklin Roosevelt ran for president in 1932 against Herbert Hoover, and nobody really knew who he was other than that he had been whatever he had been. What was his job? Governor of New York. Yeah, okay. He was a conservative. He was, or at least not a conservative. He was he ran on a fairly conservative platform. He wasn't talking about any of the stuff that he did as president, and he rose to the occasion as president and did a brilliant job. Even his first 100 days were brilliant. And so, I continue to hope and believe in the possibility of people rising to the occasion, even if they have to run as something less than what they should be.
Exactly. My favorite quote from Roosevelt, which I use a lot, was when he was visited by a pressure group, a progressive pressure group, and he said, "You know, you convinced me you're right. Now go out and put some pressure on me in order that I'll do it."
There you go. Yeah, well said.
Well, the truth is, Hillary could take more progressive stands, but if we're not there to pressure the president and our elected officials into doing it, it really doesn't matter what stance they take.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think this whole thing with Lieberman is going to be, particularly if he loses in the primary, it's going to be a huge wake up call for these DLC Dems, for Hillary and Biden and Evan Bayh in particular, and it's that bunch.
Well, good. And I'm about to give some indications that maybe things are not as bleak as we had.
Well, which in fact is what I wanted to talk to you about. Apparently four major unions, SEIU, AFT, NEA, and laborers, are growing. Tell me about that, Alan.
Okay. Not only are they growing, but I was put onto this by a story in The Record, which is a New Jersey newspaper, that union membership has been increasing in the state of New Jersey.
Now, are we talking in absolute numbers or
yes,
in percentage of population?
Absolutely.
What about his percentage of workers? Because, you know, we know that there's actually more union members now than there were when Reagan came into office. But as a percentage of the population, they've gone from being 25% to about 11% of the workforce.
Right. It, both. I mean, we're not talking here about a tidal wave, but we're talking about growth. Membership grew from 745,000 in 2004 to 791,200 in 2005.
This is in New Jersey.
And this is not a huge growth state, New Jersey. So percentage of the workforce grew from 19.8 to 20.5, the highest number since 2000, which is interesting because it had dipped and is rising again.
Now, I would submit to you, Alec, and I know you're affiliated with the AFL-CIO, that part of the reason why is because Change to Win broke off from the AFL-CIO.
Well, that's an interesting theory, but I don't believe that is in fact the case, and I can tell you what it is. I mean, that may have energized some of the unions to fight harder.
Okay, well, we have 1 minute left, so
okay.
give us the punchline.
Well, what he said, the head of the AFL-CIO there said, that this has been the result of a five-year plan that involved not only commitment to organizing on the part of the unions, but a directed plan to put rank and file union members in political positions, which is almost essential. And they elected over 400 rank and file people to local and state positions. There's seven or eight of them in the legislature, including heads of two important committees working on workplace issues. They helped elect the governor. So when they tried to pass a card check law last year, it was able to go through the legislature and it was signed. Now, this is not going to work in a right to work state. It's not going to work easily, but it works. And it shows that this kind of concerted, thought out action will do the trick.
There you go. Well, that's great. I am so glad to hear that labor is growing. Alec Dubrow, ILCAOnline.org. You can learn all about it right over at that website. Alec, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
America is beautiful, but she has an ugly side. We're looking for a leader in this country far and wide.
He or she is out there somewhere.
We're looking for a leader with the great spirit on his side. Looking for a leader.
And welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Congressman John Doolittle of California, the fine Republican who claims that he is a reform-minded Republican. Yeah. Well, roll call, which is the nonpartisan, essentially, publication on Capitol Hill. Just, you know, here's what's going on in politics today kind of thing. Notes this from Think Progress. Amanda posted it over at thinkprogress.org. Notes today that since he entered office in 1991, okay, here's a guy who's been around 15 years in the House of Representatives. He's tried to boost lawmakers' compensation and perks. He argued for a core of staff to assist the members to perform routine tasks like drive him to airports, pickups and deliveries. An additional automobile to use around the nation's capital. He wants the government to pay for the moving expenses of lawmakers when they relocate to Washington, D.C. Actually, that doesn't, frankly, to me, I mean, you know, a lot of employers, not a lot of, some employers pay for moving expenses if it's somebody that they really, I don't have a problem with that one, I'm sorry. But in any case, Doolittle spokesman Dan Blackenberg tried to justify the congressman's remarks. He says he thinks that members of the House, the staff, and all federal employees should have the same benefits that all Americans are insured with, pointing out that federal employees, for example, currently don't receive dental or vision benefits.
Well, as the folks at thinkprogress.org suggest, or as Amanda does over there, she says, Doolittle needs to get out of Abramoff's skybox and talk to some real Americans. 41% of the American middle class don't even have basic health insurance for all or part of 2005. Only 29% of companies offer dental and vision benefits. Doolittle and his spokesman also need to chuck his federal health insurance program. While most plans don't offer vision and dental benefits, some do. This is, you know, in a way, it's kind of a cheap shot at a guy. But on the other hand, you know, if that's the rationale you're going to use, I mean, this is for John Doolittle. I mean, the bottom line is that health care should be a right. It should not be a privilege or a benefit. It shouldn't be something that, you know, goes to the privilege. It should simply be a right. Very simple and very straightforward. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartmann.com and say hi. A lot going on in the chat room. Finn over there. Tom, did not Jefferson say that a revolution may be necessary to preserve democracy in the future? This may be that time. Well, yes and no. Jefferson said a few imprudent things at the beginning of the French Revolution. And there were high hopes among many of the revolutionary era that the French Revolution was going to follow the footsteps of the American Revolution. And so he said, you know, a little revolutionary now and then is not a bad thing, and that it might even invigorate democracy. And he did suggest, rather outspokenly, in several of his letters and in his personal notes, that every generation, every 19 years, should revisit the Constitution. In fact, he said not to do so would be the same thing as asking a man to wear the coat that his father wore, or the coat that he wore as a child. And yet, after the French Revolution went wrong and the terrors after all of that stuff, you know, Jefferson backed off considerably on that. It's time for a political revolution in the United States. I want to just wrap up this thing we were talking about, the cost of war in Iraq and the consequences of the war in Iraq and what's going on in Iraq. Now, keep in mind, this all started out. I started this whole rant with this full-page ad that was in the New York Times over the weekend, on the Sunday edition of the New York Times. 10 CEOs call for this CEO to be canned, with a picture of Don Rumsfeld. And they say that $439 billion later, you know, 3 years and $439 billion. Well, if you take the most conservative number possible, which would be just publicly appropriated and spent money. Now, obviously, we spent a lot beyond the money that was just appropriated for Iraq. But you could argue that some of that money would have been spent whether we were in Iraq or not. It was just, you know, the cost of operating the military. So somewhere between $282 billion and $439 billion is the real number so far. And then when you include into that the cost of things like caring for the veterans that have been wounded, we have some 20,000 casualties now. Americans who have been severely wounded. And not to mention potentially hundreds of thousands suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and other serious trauma, psychological trauma. We're now seeing, for example, homeless veterans. We'll get to that in just a second. What could we have done with this money, this $282,647,231,000, and the clock keeps ticking, $282,647,000 and change. What could we have done with this? This is from the Center of the National Priorities Project, CostOfWar.com. We could have paid for four-year scholarships at public universities. Now, just consider the impact of this. If we were just to put kids to say, you know, if you want to go to college for full 4 years, all expenses, full scholarships, for, say, 10,000 kids, 100,000 kids, 500,000 kids, you want a generation of doctors and lawyers and engineers and scientists and ecologists and, you know, people who are alternative energy engineers. You want to change
the face of America. You want to pitch NAFTA and CAFTA to us by saying that the world is now flat and that we have to compete based on our knowledge? Okay. I don't entirely buy the premise, but let's just say for a moment that it's true. Shouldn't we be investing in public education that goes up to and through college? Most of the other fully industrialized countries of the world do. If you're smart in Germany, regardless of how much money your parents have, you can go all the way to your PhD. The same is true of most European countries. Certainly it's true of many of the Middle Eastern countries that are oil rich. What if we could have paid for full four-year scholarships for 13,702,133 students? Just say, okay, we're going to have a national lottery, 13 million, or just the 13 million students applying to public universities who have the highest grades. Full four-year scholarship. That's just the $282 billion that we've spent so far in Iraq, which is about half of the $439 billion that the administration says we've spent in Iraq and that it's cost us. And it's about a third of what a Nobel Prize-winning economist has predicted the total cost is going to be when you figure in the cost of veterans care and everything else. So arguably, we could have paid for as many as 70 million full four-year scholarships at public universities. It's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. You say, okay, what about public homelessness? We have veterans now from the Iraq War who are homeless. In fact, it's a growing trend. There's a movie, an award-winning movie, just won an award. There's a New York-made documentary that won an award at the Tribeca Film Festival. It's called When I Came Home, and it's about a vet who comes home to homelessness. Reuters, an article by Daniel Trotta in today's paper, last Friday. So it'll be in newspapers all over the country. If it wasn't over the weekend, it might be today. Starts out with the story of Vanessa Gamboa. She went into the Army. They promoted her to a sergeant. She says, they promoted me to sergeant. I knew my job, but I didn't know anything about combat, so I'm responsible for all these people, and I don't know what to tell them but to duck. The battle on the supply run ended without casualties, but it did little to steel Gamboa for what awaited her back home in Brooklyn. When the single mother was discharged in April, after her second tour in Iraq, she was 24, had little money, no place to live. She slept in her son's daycare center. Gamboa is part of a small but growing trend among U.S. veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars. Homelessness. There are nearly 200,000 homeless veterans in America right now. Well, with the $282,648,000,000 we've spent so far on the war in Iraq, we could have built 2,544,980 housing units and simply said to people, here, it's yours. You own it. You can sell it if you want, you can rent it out, or you can live in it. Become an entrepreneur. Have some ownership in your... I've always said, my biggest problem with public housing is that basically we say you can live in it, but the government still owns it. We should simply give them to people and say, you own it now. And you'll find suddenly people are painting them and fixing them up and putting roofs on and making sure that everything, instead of going, somebody kicked in the wall. We could have built and given away 2,544,000 housing units with the money we've spent in Iraq so far. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. That Neil Young, his new album, Living with War, 51, and then he goes through this flip, flop, flip, flop, and they've got all these quotes of Bush in there. It's a hoot. It is a great, great album. Some marvelous music. Neil Young is a musical genius, absolute genius. Welcome back to our program. Business Week has an article in the new issue, the issue that's just coming out this week. I'm not even sure it's on the stands yet. It may be today that it's on the stands. That may help explain, this according to TPM Muckraker, one of the blogs out there, that may help explain how AT&T and Bell South can say they didn't help the NSA, the National Security Agency, despite the fact that they have your and my phone records. And this actually is a little disconcerting. Because what it suggests is that this isn't just the government going and saying, we'd like the phone records, by the way, for last month. No, it's not that. It's an ongoing process. I'll just share with you a few sentences here from this Business Week article. The headline, "The Snooping Goes Beyond Phone Calls." How the government sidesteps the Privacy Act by purchasing commercial data. Which, by the way, has to raise the question, who else could be purchasing this data? See, I think that we need privacy laws that say that corporations that have our personal information are forbidden by law, not just by business practices, but by law, from giving away or sharing that information. Well, anyway, back to this as Business Week lays it out. Buying commercially collected data allows the government to dodge certain privacy rules. The Privacy Act of 1974 restricts how federal agencies may use such information. It requires disclosure of what the government's doing with it, but the law applies only when the government is doing the data collecting. So if the government goes to a private corporation and says, give us information, if they go to your doctor and say, give us the information on this person, if they go to your phone company and say, give us it, that's not the government collecting the data. Or, no, let me back up a little bit. That would be the government collecting the data. If the government hires ChoicePoint to gather the information, then no problem. And it turns out that in fiscal 2005, last year, the last fiscal year, the Justice Department alone, which includes the FBI, they spent over $19 million to buy from private corporations names, addresses, phone numbers, and other data. And this is according to the Government Accountability Office. So the way that the AT&T and Verizon and Bell South can say, oh, we didn't give any money to the government, is very, very simple. There's this third-party company. It's called Neustar. Their symbol on the New York Stock Exchange is NSR. It's a little-known firm that helps telecom industry clients comply with government investigations. Neustar, Inc., is the name of the company. Based here, as Business Week says, based in Sterling, Virginia. Neustar, hang on just a second. Thank you. Neustar has developed a lucrative niche in the routing of millions of phone calls a day from one carrier to the next. Nearly every telephone call placed is routed through Neustar's system. And every telecommunications service provider is one of Neustar's customers, according to the company's website. So it sounds to me like what Neustar is doing is essentially the same thing as, you know, the central directory of the Internet. You type in a name, and that goes to Internic, which converts that into a number, and, you know, boom, off goes the information. Now Neustar is seeking to profit from increased post-9/11 government pressure on telecoms to turn over the data. Last year, it acquired FiduciaNet, Inc., as in fiduciary, presumably, which helps phone company clients comply with, quote, subpoenas, court orders, and law enforcement agency requests under electronic surveillance laws, end quote. The company went public last June and reported 2005 revenue of $242.5 million. Neustar also provides services to federal agencies, but CEO Jeff Ganik said it hasn't done so for the NSA,
The company, he says, has absolutely nothing to do with the surveillance that's currently being discussed on Capitol Hill. Then maybe there's another company that does. The bottom line is this, and in the midst of this, by the way, I got this mind-boggling email the other day that I sent to you, David, that I said, you know, we've got to do something with this right away. That, you know, that the liberals in Congress want to put the internet under government control. Right? Stop internet government control of the internet. Really what it is they want AT&T to control the internet under the rubric of a free market. I mean, this is outrageous. Well, it's the same. I mean, they've already done it with the phone companies. They've already done it. Tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Dan Gaynor's statement the liberals want the price of gas to go up. Kevin Donaher is going to be with us from Global Exchange. He's going to be talking about why introducing folks to different cultures drives social and economic justice. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.